Hey, everybody. Welcome to another episode of DFE. I'm your co-host, Black Cinephile.
And I'm your co-host, Brad.
There's your great co-host, Brad. And on this one, we have a great matchup here of home invasion thrillers. We have 1967's Wait Until Dark versus 2002's Panic Room. This is a pretty good lineup, man. I remember I saw Wait Until Dark for the first time a few weeks ago, and I said, you know what, this, I gotta find a film that this would go well with. And I remember a long time ago, David Fincher had a film called Panic Room, and I said, you know what, that sounds like a good lineup. What do you think about these?
Yeah, I think that's a perfect lineup between these two movies, because while Wait Until Dark is an older film, it has that same kind of, the person that is putting you in danger is in the room with you kind of vibe that Panic Room has as well. Like, they're very close thrillers that take place in a singular space. And I absolutely love when movies can do this properly, where an entire movie can basically take place on a single set, and you don't feel like you're constrained because of that. And the usage of that medium for both of these movies fits perfectly for what they're going for. It didn't feel like it was kind of bottled down to that set and we were losing out on anything. Yeah, it actually felt more close as a result.
I completely agree. Like, when you're watching these films here, I'd argue that, you know, they both use their tension very well. Like, they use like the limited amount of time. Well, not limited amount of time, but they use their runtime very well, where there's little to no fluff.
Yes, absolutely. And I think there's no better way for us than just jumping right into this one.
Hey, I agree with you, man. Now, listen, this is a chronological free zone, but I feel like Wait Until Dark is kind of like a good one to start off with here. I know that's controversial. Trust me, we're not doing this on the next one. What do you say?
You know what? We haven't done it in chronological order in a while, so I'll let it slide for this one, even though it's typically not what we do. But I think that kicks us off with Wait Until Dark, an American psycho thriller released in 1967 from director Terrence Young. We follow the story of a blind woman who is put into a situation when some robbers are trying to get access to a doll that her husband had brought home after getting back from the airport. Unknown of what this doll is or why it's so important, the robbers have collectively created a scheme in order to try and convince this lady that she is in danger from an exterior threat, and that they are here to help her by retrieving the doll for her. That is the cusp of this movie, and it sounds like a simple idea, and it is, but it plays so well because you have these different kind of actors coming in that play the idea. So you have one character named Mike who plays the role of like a police chief that's trying to help this woman get out of this situation. You have another person that comes in and plays this distressed man that is trying to find this doll and is threatening her. You have this other person that comes in and plays basically every other role that he's needed as. But the whole thing being that because this woman is blind, she doesn't understand like who these people are, but she can clue into things that are similar about them. Like the fact that one person wears a very specific perfume, so she can clue in and be like, well, that's the same person. You know, his son and his grandfather, they both wear the exact same perfume. They wear the exact same shoes that squeak when they take a left step. And so there's a lot about this one that from that simple plot where it starts getting very methodical with it.
Yeah, absolutely. You know why I love this film is because and we're going to talk about this with Panic Room too. I love the elements of it because, you know, a simple home invasion thriller is great. But like you said, there's elements to this that make it like, you know, not your typical home invasion thriller. Like the main lady that lives in the apartment, you know, played by Audrey Hepburn, Susie Hendricks, is blind. You know what I mean? So like you said, with the squeaks and everything like that, you would feel like, oh man, she's toast. She can't even see these dudes. But you know, she's resourceful at the same time. You know, like she's not a blind person that doesn't know how to use her wits about her to know what's going on. Mm-hmm. And yeah, man, you know, for a film that was released in the 60s, dude, the music score, the tension, everything is A1 in this movie as it goes on.
Yeah, absolutely. The tension in this movie is held so well because the entire time you know that she's in danger because these people have previously killed someone else. And you're aware that, you know, if they don't get this doll, which we don't even still know, like, what the importance of the doll is. At the beginning of the movie, we see somebody sewing the doll back together and everything and handing it off to a woman who later at the airport hands it off to Susie's husband, who brings it home. Mm-hmm. And they have no idea what is about this doll whatsoever, you know. Mm-hmm. And I love the story that the robbers kind of create to try and get the doll, where they're just like, a deranged man runs into the apartment and starts just shuffling things around like, I'm looking for it. You know, I know he's here. And it's such a weird, twisted story of how, like, she gets manipulated by, you know, the one person, Mike, played by Richard Crenna. And it's such a wonderful thing where you know all the pieces and the movie doesn't hide anything from the viewer. What's hidden from the actress is who all these people are and what their real motives are. So as she's like going in with their scheme, you kind of get that like clenching feeling of like, oh no, that's not right. You know, don't trust them. You know, like it's obviously a scam, but we have the forethought to see through it because we're seeing it as it's happening and from the beginning.
Absolutely. And yeah, I love, again, the elements of this film. So I want to say, as far as acting goes, you know, while Alan Arkin and Audrey Hepburn, like, you know, kind of like arguably steal the show here, I love Richard Crenna as Mike. Mm-hmm. Because I love his scenes with Susie where he's like posing as like, you know, like I believe he's posing as like her husband's old army buddy and things of that nature. I love his performance. Like, I love how, you know, you see a little bit of like a similar to Forrest Whitaker's character in Panic Room. You see he's kind of morally ambivalent about all this stuff. Like, she's blind and we're kind of throwing her for a loop. Like, you see he's like trying to stay in character of this, like this character that he's portraying, but mm-hmm. he feels a little torn about what he's doing at the same time.
Oh yeah. You also have the one girl that lives in the apartment across or the apartment above. I can't remember what it was. Gloria, who is the little girl. Mm-hmm. And I love how her introduction in the movie is she's helping out with getting like Susie groceries and stuff because she's blind and everything. And at the same time, she's still like a little bratty about it all and everything.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And I love how that's how they kind of introduce her, because it's like, yeah, this is a kid. You know, this isn't somebody that should be like in an adult role at all within this movie. But she plays like an important role of giving Susie information visually that she wouldn't be able to get otherwise.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Yeah, Gloria is a great helping hand in this movie. And I love how everything just like, you know, I get a little bit to the climax here. I love how everything kind of like builds to a great tension. Like, you know, when Mike comes back and he realizes that, you know, okay, she knows that he's not who he says he is. He says, listen, just give me the doll. You know, like, you know, we're going to take care of Rote. Like he's done. But I love that scene in the car lot where, like, you know, Carlino shows up. And then all of a sudden you just see flashlights turn up on a car, and then, you know, Rote just goes and like runs him over. Mm-hmm. I thought that was a pretty nice, I don't want to say jump scare scene, but that was a pretty nice surprise.
Yeah.
Because this guy's the main villain. You ain't going to get rid of him that easy. And I just love that final, like, you know, that final confrontation between Rote. I think that's how you say his name. Rote and Susie. And I love how, you know, she uses his wits against him by, you know, he tries to set the apartment on fire. And then, you know, he tries to use matches to see, but then, you know, she douses him with gasoline.
Yep.
And I'm like, dude, this woman is so smart, dog. Like, that's one of the best confrontations ever. And I like how at one point, you know, there's a time where, you know, she's starting to get away. And this scene actually did kind of like make me jump. There's a scene where she's walking away and then out of nowhere, Rohit jumps and the camera kind of zooms in on him jumping on her and stopping her. I was mm-hmm. like, oh, shoot. That kind of made me jump a little bit. What was your response to that?
Yeah, I don't know if it really got a jump out of me because it kind of was expected, especially in the scenes where they're playing with the light and the dark and everything like that. Mm-hmm. It's kind of what I was expecting to happen. So it didn't really get me. But some of the brilliance of that is how after she realizes that like Mike is against her and all these people are just fake and she doesn't understand what's fully going on, but she knows she's in danger. She starts going around the house and like disconnecting all the light bulbs, unplugging all the lamps and everything there in the house. She even goes into the hallway and like smashes the lights with her walking cane. And basically the only light left in the house is one that is like over this, I'm trying to remember what kind of light it was. It's one of those heating lights for like photography and everything. So the light in, I can't remember what the name of those kind of lights are, but it's the only light that's in the house at this point as people are like walking in and out of it and able to see. And yeah, it absolutely plays with the medium 100% in the perfect way. I absolutely loved every part of this movie and how it plays out.
Mm-hmm. You know, another good film, I mean, we already made our choice, but you know a good film that this film would have paired up with as well is Don't Breathe.
Don't Breathe, I think, has more of a horror aspect to it than this one, but I do get like the whole like blind person, but I think the difference there is this movie, the blind person is the victim, while in Don't Breathe, the blind person is more of the threat.
No, he is, absolutely. But I was saying more of the home invasion aspect, too.
Oh, okay.
Like,
yeah.
You're invading the home of a person that is blind. Like, you know what I mean? But, yeah, I hear what you're saying. Yeah, man. Terrific film. I love the climax of it. I think Alan Arkin was a terrific villain. You know, Audrey Hepburn is terrific in the lead role. Now, here's the thing about this film. A few interesting things. You know, Audrey was nominated for Best Actress at the Academy Award. I think this was her last film for a while. She stepped away from acting after this movie for a little bit. But here's the weirdest thing about this movie. So at the Golden Globes, the guy that was nominated for Best Supporting Actor was the husband.
Really? The guy that has like two entire scenes in this movie and can be... If they had to cut 5 minutes of this movie, he would definitely be the part that's cut.
Yes. I was like, why? Because that's why I know there had to be some politics behind it back then.
Right. Well,
there's politics now. But I was like, what, two scenes? Like you nominated him for two scenes? Like, at least nominate the guy that played Mike, or at the very most, nominate Alan Arkin. But they nominate the husband for Best Supporting Actor at the Globes. And I'm like, that's incorrect.
That sounds like if they were to have like the Oscars for best song, they decided to have one from the Barbie movie and not do I'm Just Ken as the winner. You know, it's that crazy of an idea.
Right. Yeah, that's funny. Yeah, absolutely. That's wild. But overall, man, I think for a film that was made in the 60s, the tension is played very well in this movie. I think it's a very well-crafted thriller. I give this a straight 4 out of 5.
I have this one as a 4.5 out of 5. I absolutely love this movie. Anytime a movie can do a really good plot line in a singular space like this, I'm always behind it.
Mm-hmm. Okay. I hear you. All right. Awesome. All right. So straight 4 out of 5. Well done. All right. So we're going to move on to the next one here. That leads us to Panic Room, 2002 thriller directed by the one and only David Fincher. Now, this is a film in which Jodie Foster and a very young Kristen Stewart are a mother and daughter who, you know, who have just moved into a new home. The father is, you know, a rich pharmacist tech, well, a rich pharmacist CEO out on business and with his mistress. So they move into a new home, and it's equipped with a very tech-savvy panic room, which is a room you can lock yourself into, you know, giving you run into a situation where, you know, a robber's coming to the house or you're in danger, which, you know, lo and behold, the mother and daughter duo here, what was their names? Hold on, let me get their names together. Meg and Sarah, you know, happen to find themselves in a very dangerous situation where robbers, played by Forrest Whitaker, a very young Jared Leto and Dwight Yoakam, come in the house looking for a you know, mysterious, priceless, you know, object. So Panic Room follows, you know, Jodie Foster and Kristen Stewart locking themselves in the room, trying to make it through the night while trying to evade the burglars who have, you know, invaded their house. But what they need happens to be in the panic room that the mother and daughter have locked themselves into. And that's the bare bones plot of Panic Room. Dude, this is an underrated Fincher classic, man. I remember seeing this film in theaters. Now, did you see this in theaters?
I did not. This is actually the first time that I've seen this one. I will say that in 2002, I wasn't as much of a movie buff as I am now. So when something like this was coming out, if it wasn't Spider-Man or like the Rugrats movie, I wasn't caring about going to the theaters for it at that point in time.
I got you. Hey, I understand. Yeah, dude, this was a film where even in the theater, because I went to see this with my mom, you could feel the tension in the theater, dude. Like, one thing Fincher has always been good at is establishing mood, atmosphere, and tone. Mm-hmm. And you can see this even with a film like this, like, released back in 2002. Yeah, dude. So watching this film today, you know, I watched it with my wife. I said, look, let's watch a thriller. You know, let's watch a thriller called Panic Room. You know, you'll like it. And I said, just trust me on this one. You don't need to watch a trailer. Let's just watch it. So we watched it together, and I could tell, like, through certain scenes, especially as you're heading towards the climax, I could feel her getting tense. Mm-hmm. Like, this film does make you tense, especially as it like goes on and on.
Yeah. A lot of that brought on by Raul, played by Dwight Yoakman. He absolutely plays that, especially near the beginning of the movie, the very like silent threat of, I love how, you know, when they're starting to do the robbery and everything like that, you have Burnham and Junior are the two people that are kind of like in acquaintance with each other. Burnham was the person that created the vaults and everything. Mm-hmm. Junior is the person who, I believe, his grandfather owned the property prior, mm-hmm. and he knew about stuff hidden in there. And then you just have Raul there. And I love how Burnham's like, who's this guy? This is my hired help for this situation. Why do we need him? This is a quick in and out operation.
Yeah, absolutely. Listen, listen, man, Dwight Yoakam, dog, this is a country singer, bro. Like, yeah. The fact that a country singer, and put respect on his name, he's an actor and filmmaker too, but the fact that a country singer was willing to put a very like sinister performance out of this, bravo, man.
Yeah.
And listen, bravo to everybody in here. Everybody came with their A game. Even a young Kristen Stewart. But yeah, he was great.
Yeah. And yeah, you keep saying like young Kristen Stewart and young Jared Leto. Forrest Whitaker just looks the same in this movie as he does today. I love how he has aged,
man,
so
black
gracefully.
Don't crack, baby.
That you're just like, oh yeah, this is still Forrest Whitaker from 20 years ago, but it just looks like Forrest Whitaker. It doesn't look like somebody different. Like Jared Leto, you could tell me that this is somebody else, and I'd be like, oh yeah, I love their portrayal. And then going, yeah, it was Jared Leto. It's like, oh, that was Jared Leto. And then Kristen Stewart is literally just a kid in this one. It's pretty hard to pinpoint that one to her.
For sure. Yeah, dude. And it's like looking at a time capsule for real. And you know, what I love is that, you know, Forrest Whitaker is able to play many roles, whether he's playing like the hero or the villain, or the villain or the hero masked as a villain, you know, like, or a villain masked as hero. He's always like been a chameleon in that aspect. But what I love about this film is that, you know, once everything starts setting in, you know, we see them move into the house and everything like that. But I love the tracking shots that David Fincher uses when you see the robbers like coming into the house. Like, you got them coming towards the front door, then you see the camera goes to the side, the back door. You see them put the ladder up and climb up. I'm like, that's a good POV shot that he had there.
Yeah. There's a lot of great kind of like things like the vent system when the camera's going through there, when it's going through that pipe that leads outside and everything. Like, there's a couple great like shots of it tracking through a moment that are done absolutely fantastic. And yeah, it's I love how even with this, you have the person that made these like vaults or the panic rooms for people to be able to go into with Burnham, where I love that one of his lines is even, you know, look, man, I made these vaults specifically to stop people like us from trying to do what we're doing now. These things are impenetrable.
But here's my thing. Like, I guess they didn't know they were supposed to be home, right? Or, like, because, like, my thing is, like, go ahead.
They didn't know that the house had sold. Okay. I believe that's what it was, because they came to get stuff from the vault, and I believe they, one, didn't know that the house was sold, or two, didn't expect people to already be in it, because it was supposed to be a quick jump into the vault, you know, get to the safe that's in there and get out kind of operation. And even in the case that somebody is there, they were supposed to just go straight to the panic room, get to the vault, take what's in there, and then get out. It wasn't supposed to involve anybody else. There wasn't supposed to be any threat of anything else.
And I love, you know, what I love about David Cope's screenplay here. And, you know, if you know David Cope, you know, he wrote, you know, the first two Jurassic Park films, Indiana Jones and the Crystal Skull, Mission Impossible, the first one. Great screenwriter. What I love about this script here is that you have like great elements here, like Wait Until Dark, right? You have the man who was part of the robbing crew that created the panic room that they're locking themselves into. And, you know, in a simple type of movie, you lock yourself into a panic room. You know, Jodie Foster says to the guys, just take what you want and leave. Mm-hmm. Well, it's in the room that you're in. So what we need is in your room. So that's how you add tension there. And on top of that, the daughter has diabetes. So at some point you have to come out.
Right.
You know, so there's great tension elements here in this script here that I love that, you know, again, like I said, both of these films make good use of their time to like really be unpredictable. So, you know, what I like about this film here is that with each of the robbers, you have a different character. So like Jared Leto's Jr. is like, you know, very, you know, hyper and like, you know, doesn't think with his head. He's off the handle a little bit, but he's all talk and no bark. Raul is
all bark, no bite.
Oh yeah, all bark, no bite. There you go. Raul is bite. Mm-hmm. Raul is dangerous. Raul is a liability, but he's a very sinister liability. Burnham is simple, but Burnham doesn't want to hurt anybody. He just wants to get the money, get in and get out. Burnham is, I guess you would call the professional.
Yep.
So you got three vastly different criminals here. So I love that you have that as well. So, you know, when you're dealing with the characters of Meg and Sarah, you know, Meg is a estranged wife who knows her husband's cheating on her, you know, trying to like, you know, keep her connection with her daughter strong. And you can tell they have a connection. You can tell they love each other. But yeah, you know, they're in this house alone on the wrong night. And so like moving on with the tension and everything, I love the different ways they actually try to get themselves out of the thing. Like, I love the idea they have where they're flashing the flashlight through the little hole.
Yeah, the SOS.
Yeah, SOS. I love how the guy just wakes up, looks around, He just closes the blinds. It just goes back to sleep.
As soon as he got up and he started walking to the window, I was like, he's going to just close the blinds, isn't he? I'm calling you right now. He's just going to close the blinds. And then he like looks around and I'm like, oh, is the movie going to... Nope, he's closing the blinds. Okay, I got it.
That's awesome. Yeah, so he did that. So I like the different way, like they try to make a call. She makes a call to her ex-husband, her husband, still mm-hmm. her husband, says, like, you know, mistress answer. She says, yo, God, get him on the phone, you know, you B-word. And then she goes, he says, hey, we need help. And then the line disconnects. I love the moment's attention. I love the moment she gets out of the panic room and she gets back just in time. Like two times that happens throughout the movie. I love the moment's attention. I love how at the same time, Burnham is pretty smart too, because he created this room, so he knows little ways on how to like try to, you know, get in there, try to get them out at least to get the bonds that's in the panic room. Like, I love the idea he comes out with. And again, this shows like the different personalities of each of the dudes. He gets the propane gas tank mm-hmm. and chooses to put it in the vent. He says, okay, we're just going to do this to send a message. And Raul is like, turn it up. He's like, we're sending a message. And then, you know, Junior is kind of on the split, like, well, I guess turn it up a little bit. But yeah, we just need to get in there. And then Raul was like, turn it up. And he grabs the gas tank. And I love this scene so much. You know, Meg and Sarah, you know, they create that little hole like to make an airflow out of the panic room. But I like how she comes up with that lighter. And then all you hear, you see Burnham, like, I don't know if it was Burnham or if it was Junior.
Junior.
Okay. So Junior put his ear to the wall and you hear a lot of clicking. And then Burnham was like, wait a minute, get away from the wall. And I just love how that big blast of fire comes out and it just wraps Junior up in like a big blow of fire. And I thought that scene was pretty cool.
Yeah, that scene is ballsy too on her part of just being like, oh yeah, they're filling this room with propane. Let me just light this lighter up in this room and hope that these fireproof blankets that are in this room are good enough to like save us from this. And yeah, it's one of those one scenes in this movie that's like, okay, that's kind of a stretch, but it was a cool scene, so I'll let it slide kind of thing.
Yeah, it took some suspension of disbelief, you know, but I like the way he shot it. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
It's a 2002 movie.
Right. Yeah, it definitely has there's a couple things in this movie where it's like, okay, you got to suspend disbelief here. But I do love how strong-headed like they are when it comes to trying to get into the safe. Like mm-hmm. I remember one of the plans that Junior has, I think it was Junior's plan to get into the safe, was digging up from the bottom,
the sledgehammer.
And so stupid. I remember Burnham just going, look, let's say you happen to get to the steel, which you're never going to be able to break through. There's still 3 inches of cement that you'd have to break through on top of that. And then break it.
No, it said, let's say you get through the cement. There's 3 inches of steel.
Oh, that's
that you need to get through. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Yeah.
And I love how they just stare at him and then they just get back to using the sledgehammer.
Right. there's some of the other scene, like even when they finally get into the safe, because, you know, Meg has to run out in order to grab the medical supplies for her daughter and everything, because she's having an attack and everything. It even in that moment where they get into the safe and they crush Raul's hand in the safe door. And you have Burnham just being like, look, I need you to stand away from the safe. I need you to, you know, because she has the gun at this point. And they know that if they open the door to free his hand, she's going to shoot. And she's like, just give the medicine to my daughter. We'll give you the medicine to your daughter if you go downstairs, leave the gun. And they're like watching the security cameras and she still has a gun. She's like, I told you to you know what? I don't even care anymore. And just releases the door. It lets Raul's hand get back in. And then Raul just gets on the thing and is like, you bitch, I'm going to kill you. I'm going to kill your daughter. I'm going to kill everybody you ever cared about. You know,
That hand crush is like one of the most satisfying scenes in this movie.
Oh, absolutely.
Because like, I was like, because my wife was like, yeah, that's what you get, you bastard. Like, you know, like that, that was a satisfying scene. And you're just seeing him cry like a little baby, like, ah.
Right.
Oh, a brilliant scene. It happened after this. But yeah, you know, the husband comes home. You know, they beat him nearly half to death. Well, Raul beats him nearly half to death after shooting Junior. But I love how, you know, they're in the room and they're with Sarah, you know, so Meg is like scattering around, you know, trying to make sure her husband's okay too. I love that scene with the policeman. And I love the way Fincher, I love how Fincher directs this scene. I love how David Copes writes this scene. Like the policeman is talking to her. And this, like, Jodie Foster is great in this scene too, where the policeman's like, ma'am, you know, we got a call. Your husband said something was going on here. Oh, no, everything's fine. I'm just sleepy. Can you go away? And then she goes, before she leaves, he goes, you said there were three on the phone. She goes, what? You said on the phone there were three, and then the phone cut out. What was the three? You see the other policeman guy. He's like, dude, I want to go home. Like, right. This lady looks like nothing's going on. But you could tell he's looking at her trying to say, wait a minute, something's not right here. And I love Jodie Foster's acting in this scene where she was like, I told my husband, there are three reasons why I want you to come home in bed with me right now and, you know, get away from that mistress lady that you're with. And you see the look in her face, like she means what she's saying, even though that's not what she was saying on the phone. Mm-hmm. But you could tell she means what she's saying. And then, you know, the officers kind of feel a little bad. And then right before she leaves, he goes, miss, you know, if there's something you can't say to me right now, you know, if you blink a few times, you know, maybe you can help me understand if you're in any type of danger. And, you know, I love how Jodie Foster just tries not to blink and just stares at him, says, oh, man, you guys are good. No, we're OK. Thank you. I love the acting in that scene.
Yeah, it definitely like helps bring together, because at this point the cops have come. She's outside of the safe. You have Raul and Burnham inside the safe with her daughter and going, if the cops show up, we're killing your daughter. You know, we're getting out of this no matter what. And yeah, we kind of completely skipped when Raul kills Junior, because they find out that Junior had lied about how much money was actually in the safe and how much they were going to be getting when they split it and everything. And when Junior is like, you know what? I don't even care about the safe anymore. I'm leaving. And Raul just shoots him cold blood right there, just showing like how dangerous he is. And then he just kind of goes to Burnham, just like, yeah, so 50-50, right? And just starts walking back to the safe. And it's like, oh, it's such a cold scene, and shows just how dangerous this guy is.
Yeah, absolutely. So, he's a very dangerous character. So I love that things ratchet up from that perspective. And yeah, man, the final confrontation is just terrific, dude. You know, when Burnham, Meg, and Raul, you know, leave the room. You know, like, I love how Meg chooses to, like, again, kind of a parallel to Wait Until Dark, like, cuts all the lights out, cuts all the electricity off. So you got to a point where Meg's husband, you know, is taped to the, well, not taped, but he's in the chair, and he's got the gun in his hand, where, you know, just before Meg is trying to see, okay, lift your arm, because I need to know if you can lift the gun. And you got that great tension, that great fight between, you know, Meg, Raul, and her husband, where, you know, initially, you know, Burnham, he has the bonds in his jacket. He's about to buck it out of there. But, you know, and you learn that Burnham has a kid, too, and he's has a custody battle going on. He hears Sarah scream. Because, you know, like, you got that terrible scene where Raul is about to put a sledgehammer down on Jodie Foster. And then, you know, Forrest just comes in and, like, you know, blows him away. And I said, man, that's a terrific final ending.
Right. And even that, a little bit before that, when she's preparing for everything, I love how one of the things she does is she just knocks out all the cameras and mm-hmm. Burnham and Raoul are just inside of the panic room. And I think it's Raoul that goes, man, why didn't we think of that when we were out there? We should have done that. Because the entire time while Meg was in the panic room, she could see where in the house they all were to know, like, if it was safe for her to run out of the panic room to try and get stuff based off the cameras and being able to see everything. So I love that they actually even make reference to the fact of they should have really taken all the cameras out in order to be able to sneakily run around the house without her knowing where they are. And none of them had thought of that.
Yeah, absolutely. Like, again, that's the thing where you got three different personalities here as criminals. But, you know, at the end of the day, you miss something that simple as a mark.
Mm-hmm. But yeah, this is absolutely a fantastic movie that plays tension very well in the limited space that it has. And I don't know, was there anything else that you wanted to bring up on this movie?
You know, so when it comes to certain things, like a little bit like behind the scenes, right? You know, what I like is that in line with other Fincher films, right? You know, the credit sequence is so fast. Like he wastes no time on credits. It'd be like, you know, like 60 seconds of credits and be like, okay, let's get on to what we're doing here. I like how the script, the way Fincher and Cope worked on the script is that we got rid of the exposition very fast. We a mother and daughter moving into the house. The father is rich. That's all we need to know to like get things going here. Mm-hmm. But initially, Nicole Kidman was supposed to be in the lead role. But, you know, she had a little bit of an injury and then she got recast with Jodie Foster. I thought that was really interesting because Jodie Foster is terrific in this film. And I wonder how Nicole Kidman is terrific, too. But I wonder how she would have been in the lead role as well.
Yeah, it's a shame that she got trapped in that AMC for the last 42 years now, I believe it's been.
Oh, yeah. You know, hey, man, she wants to go where movies are magic, dude.
Right.
You know, she goes to a place, you know, where you can find comfort, adventure, because, you know, we need that. All of us. That's funny. But, dude, overall, man, great film. I loved it when I saw it as a kid. I love it now. I give this a 4.5.
Yeah, I have this one as a 4 out of 5 on my radar. Okay. You know, I really like this one. It does a lot of great things. I love the jokes in it. The villains are great and everything. Yeah, I put this one at a 4 out of 5.
Okay. Awesome. All right. So when it comes down to it, I guess you and I are split. You're more on Wait Until Dark. I'm more Panic Room.
Yeah, I think when it comes to playing the thriller in kind of a singular space kind of idea of this, Wait in the Dark just has such a better way of kind of putting the tension there in the fact that there's no barrier between the characters. There's nothing keeping her safe from these people, except for the fact that she's unaware of where this doll is that they're looking for. And they believe that she knows where it is. It's not the same situation in Panic Room where they're trying to get into the room that she's in.
Okay. Yeah, I understand. Yeah, I love Panic Room a little bit more because of, like, you know, Fincher's direction. I love that, you know, I think he used, like, you know, like, I don't know what the kind of technology was called, but I like the way he filmed it. I don't know what the time of technology was called, but I like the technology he used for the time to like where you had like that 2000 CGI where it looks like you're moving through like a whole house in real time, like a 3D type of. Yeah, I like that he did that, but it didn't look cheesy when he was doing it.
Yep.
You know what I mean? So I like that. I love Jodie Foster's performance. Forest Whitaker. I love the whole cast here. Yeah, I just give Panic Room a little bit of an edge. So I guess we're at a draw.
Okay. Yeah, and this is a good episode to be on a draw on because, yeah, these are still two very good movies.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Now, I want to head into After Show with you, my man. Now, I know what I saw in theaters. You told me you were going to see it. Did you see it?
I did catch a showing of it this morning and managed to see The Bike Riders. And, okay.
Now,
yeah.
Was I right?
You know what? It was more than I was thinking it was going to be, because based on the trailers for this one, I was just like, oh, okay. So like Tom Hardy's in Sons of Anarchy and they're turning it into a movie. Okay. I don't.
Disrespectful.
Yeah.
Disrespectful. I love Sons of Anarchy, man.
Oh, yeah. I like it too. But at the same time, I don't know if I want Sons of Anarchy packed into a 2-hour movie and just thrown at me, just starring Tom Hardy. I don't think of that as like, oh yeah, that'll be entertaining to me to just rewatch the entirety of Sons of Anarchy smashed into 2 hours.
Mm-hmm. I got you. So you got more than what you expected.
Yeah, I will say they do a lot better with the characterization and everything in the short time that they have. The way that they play it off is it's not so much following the story of them as much as it is an interview where they're telling the story of these people. I really like that plot device in it because makes it flow a lot better when they're jumping time to time, because that's one thing in this that I was worried about for it, because we see scenes in the trailers where it's like, okay, time is passing, but how are they doing these jump cuts? Because if they're not doing jump cuts properly between different time frames of this biker gang, that's where it all falls apart. You know, I don't want to see the entire life of a biker gang in 2 hours being told in kind of like a real time way.
Right. Man, I love this movie. I thought Tom Hardy knocked it out of the park. I thought Austin Butler knocked it out of the park. Mm-hmm. Jodie Comer knocked it out of the park. I love the core trio of actors we have here. I love the connection between each of the characters. I thought this was just an awesome movie. And you know what? I expected to see a good movie, but it was way better than I expected it to be, dude. Like same as you. And when I went to the theater, it was packed. And I didn't expect it to be packed.
See, when I went to my theater, granted, I went to like the first showing of the day, 11 a.m. kind of showing. There were like 5 other people in the theater with me.
Okay. Now, I was Friday night, right? So, you know, opening night is technically Thursday, depending on like when the film comes out.
Right.
But I didn't expect it to be a full house. Like, because I was like, this film is popular. Because like I always look at this like an independent film, and you know, for a while, like during the writer's strike, you know, the film like changed hands between Searchlight and Focus Features. So like there's that. But yeah, man, it was a full house, and I was like, oh, okay. So yeah, I thoroughly enjoyed this film, dude. I love how it's like it feels like an American film, and when I say that. Certain films you watch, right? Like There Will Be Blood, Foxcatcher. These films are like American storytelling because they're rooted in American myth and American history. This film feels like that. And Jeff Nichols does that with a lot of his films, like Mud, Take Shelter, Midnight Special. Yeah, dude, this is a straight 5 out of 5 to me. I loved it.
Yeah, I will say, I'm not quite at that level with it. I have this as like a solid 4.5. And
fair enough.
It absolutely does a lot better than I was expecting from the trailers, because this is one of those times where normally I'll see a trailer for a movie, I'll go, okay, that looks really good. And then I'll watch it and be like, well, that wasn't quite there. This is one of the few times where it's reversed, where I'll see a trailer and go,
reverse.
I don't think I'd like that. And then go and watch and go, you know what? That was a good movie. I enjoyed that movie.
Yeah, man. I you know me. I don't always go by the trailers because I'm like, well, you know, it could be different from what you're seeing. I like to wait until it comes out. And if I like the director, if I trust the director, I'll go see it regardless of what the reviews are. Or if I don't know anything about the director, I go, let me see what the reviews are saying. But yeah, man, I'm glad I saw this. I really wish this would have came out when it was supposed to come out. But you know, it coming out now is fine.
Right.
But yeah, dude, great film. I thought it was great.
Yeah. I had forgotten from the preview or from the trailers and everything that Norman Reedus was in this movie. So when he popped on screen, I was just like, Wait a minute. Oh, that's Norman. You know what? That makes sense that he would be in a biker movie. You know what? I have no qualms with this. I'm actually feel like an idiot for forgetting that he was in this movie up until he showed up.
Me too. And he was pretty great as well. Yeah, man, we might, who knows? We might save it for a future episode or something. But I wanted to say, you know, something that's been like the talk of the town among, you know, cinephiles and moviegoers. Did you catch the Nosferatu trailer?
I did, and I'm iffy on it. It looks like it's going to be a decent horror movie, but I feel like it's going too much on shock factor for its horror vibe that it's giving.
Have you seen a Robert Eggers movie before?
I don't know if I have, actually. I'll be honest. I'm trying to... What else has he come out with?
The Lighthouse.
Yes, I have seen that.
Okay. The Northman, The Witch.
I've seen The Northman. You made me watch that one.
I did?
Oh, yeah, long back when that came out a couple of years ago?
Did I? What do we do that episode with?
That is a great question. I do not remember whatsoever. But
I made you watch The Northman.
We have.
Okay.
We might not have done a versus on it, but I remember you said that I needed to watch that one, and I did.
Oh, okay. Okay, guy. I understand. I got you. Yeah. So, you know, if you've seen those films, you know what he's about. He's a very specific type of director, a very an idiosyncratic director. He has a specific type of style. Very folkloric. So I don't think it will rely too much on shock factor, but I do think it will probably be unsettling.
Yeah, that's just because the first time I saw the trailer was when I was at the movies to see The Bike Rider. It played before that. Mm-hmm. And yeah, I got the idea of like, okay, it just seems like it's based on the trailer going more for shock value. I'll give it more time for it and everything like that. I'm not going to just judge it right off of that trailer and everything, because I know it's a first, you know, trailer to try and get interest and everything.
Yeah, absolutely. Like, you know, I think Robert Eggers is a very like, creative talent.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I always like to see what he's bringing to the table, because I say, like, you know, if anything, it will be something that I will remember in some fashion. Like, The Northman might not be one of my favorite movies, but I know when I watched it, it was definitely an experience.
Right.
I love The Lighthouse. Lighthouse is great. Not the biggest fan of The Witch, but I did see the talent in that movie. Yeah. So I'm interested to see how Bill Skarsgård, because they say he looks like butt ugly in this movie. So I'm interested to see how he looks as Nosferatu.
I will say Bill Skarsgård is absolutely fantastic at contortion and everything like that, and his like acting. It by far, you know, I didn't know if anybody else could play it or play Pennywise from it, but Bill Skarsgård is one of the few people that's like, oh yeah, when he was cast in that role, it was like, okay, I can believe in this one now. There's potential here, because was it in the TV special? Of
Tim Curry,
his voice alone is hard to like beat for Pennywise. So when they had Bill Skarsgård on there, it's like, okay, he's the one person that could actually make Pennywise terrifying without the voice.
Bill Skarsgård is a great actor for sure. I'd agree. I was going to ask a question, but they're two different actors. I was going to say, which one do you like better between him and Alexander? I'm talking about as actors.
I'd say Bill Skarsgård. I'm becoming a fan of his as of late with the different projects that he's been on, because he's been picking just a lot of fun projects that I'm enjoying.
Okay. I can understand that.
Like, there's even the one that we just talked about a couple episodes back with Boy Kills World, where it's like, he's picking fun projects that I'm enjoying.
Okay, I can definitely understand that. I think Alexander's more charismatic, is a strong actor too. But yeah, I think Bill is like very like kind of more versatile.
Yeah.
But they're both great. Yeah.
Alex is great. I think Bill's just taking more of the roles for the kinds of movies that I'm like, okay, I'm pumped up to see that one.
Okay, I got you. I hear you. Next week's going to be off the chain, man. We got A Quiet Place Day One. We got Kinds of Kindness, which did release this week, but like not nationwide. Next week is nationwide. And we got Horizon Chapter One.
Yeah. Yeah, there's a lot. I definitely intend. I'm curious on if I want to see A Quiet Place in theaters, because I remember watching the first one, and the sound design on that is like perfect for a movie theater. Like, it's hard to beat that sound design on a movie theater kind of level. But with everything else coming out around the same time, it's like, oh, okay, I know I need to see Kinds of Kindness. You know, I know that Horizon's going to be up there. It comes down to, like, who's going to have the IMAX and the Dolby showings when these are all in there?
Yeah, you're right on that. With a film like Quiet Place, if you can do it, I'd say go IMAX.
Right.
Especially that this one's being set in NYC, right? It's being set in New York City.
Yep.
I tell you to go IMAX for that one.
I feel like Horizon is going to have IMAX, because that's the more like grander movie.
I don't think so. Not what I've seen.
Really?
I think IMAX is being reserved for Quiet Place, Dolby. I don't know if Kinds of Kindness is going to be in Dolby, but I think the early event one or the early showing one is in Dolby. But
okay.
They're taking out the red carpet for Quiet Place. That's the bigger movie. Horizon is a big movie, but this is Quiet Place.
Right. Yeah, it's it definitely has its fan base.
Right. The Horizon is the start of a franchise. Quiet Place is on like movie 3.
Right. But with the grand scale of like Horizon, I feel like they would have tried to like bargain to get those IMAX showings in. But we'll see.
Well, yeah, we'll definitely see. Folks, with that being said, you know, it's been another great episode of DFV. We will catch you on the next one. And, let us know what you think about this episode, and take care.